Today's show is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you will ever wear. Ben, tell me about Mack Weldon.
Well, I've been a pretty enthusiastic Mack Weldon supporter here recently, and I got a text message from a young guy last week. He wanted to basically tell me that he hopes he finds someone in life that he loves as much as I love Mack Weldon sweatpants. Usually I try to be an optimistic voice for the next generation. I try to build people up, but I had to reply to him, good luck, because people, even the best people, even the people you fall in love with, are bound to be flawed. Nobody's perfect. Mack Weldon sweatpants, on the other hand, essentially perfect, basically perfect. I don't see any flaws. You can wear them inside. You can wear them outside. You can wear them to the store. You can wear them hanging out. They are antimicrobial, as you love to tell people. MackWeldon.com, promo code open, 20% off. Nice and easy. Let's do it.
That's right, man. Mack Weldon, that's what we're about. Look good, perform well. MackWeldon.com, get 20% off using the promo code open. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. How you doing, man? My head is kind of spinning. There's just been a lot going on here in LA these last few days. I think it's because partly it's like sneaker launch season with the holidays around the corner. Lots of basketball going down. The Clippers dropped one last night right before they got to get ready for this big tilt with the Warriors on Wednesday. Everybody's got circled on the calendar. Just feels like we're really in the thick of the NBA's busy season right now.
Is it weird for you being out there? Does it feel like holiday season when it's like 65 degrees out?
Yes, Santa Claus is wearing a bikini. Reindeers shave their whole body. Yeah, no, I do. It's kind of disorienting because are you dealing with snow? Like, I've been hearing with people dealing with snow all over the country, and it's like,
It's definitely cold out, and I don't mind it right now. The cold gets depressing in like February and March, but right now it's kind of nice. It's like winter's coming, Christmas is around the corner. When I lived out there, I was kind of bummed that we didn't have that leading up to Christmas.
Well, I hate driving in snow because I'm from Oregon, which is home to the world's worst snow drivers. People may or may not know that. So it doesn't bother me to not have to deal with that headache. And I think I also fell into that category of like 99.7% of Oregonians suffer from seasonal affect disorder because of all the rain. So
yeah.
Honestly, I'm not really complaining. It's a little cloudy today. It's throwing me off. But other than that, life's pretty good.
I'm the flip side. I love the Pacific Northwest specifically because of the rain. That's like my ideal weather. It's like 50 degrees and drizzling. But we've gotten off track. All right. So number one, end of the week here. We're doing another mailbag. So submit your questions to us on Twitter. Standard review, subscribe, tell your friends about the podcast, And today we're going to talk about James Harden at the top and Ben's adventures over the weekend. And then we're going to talk about Draymond and the drama that will never end, Steve Kerr, and Ben's SI piece for the magazine this week. But let's kick things off with your weekend, man.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, it's like sneaker season. Everybody's gearing up, right? And so we had that Jordan thing last week with Space Jam and all that. And then out of nowhere, Adidas is like, hey, we're throwing this gigantic party for James Harden. He's got his sneaker launching officially, his first signature sneaker. You should come check it out. Obviously, I said yes. That was a pretty easy decision to make. What I didn't realize was that Harden flew from Denver after they won on a back-to-back to L.A., and then he just went and like met up with his Rockets teammates in Houston like a day later. So he got a nice little side trip out of it. I'm not sure how Phil Jackson would feel about Harden and his friends. I mean, I can see Posse Comments Part 2 coming out if you looked at Harden's itinerary. Maybe some old school people wouldn't be totally down. But I mean, it was a good party. I got to say, they did a nice job.
Maybe he's just really dedicated to the brand, and he just wanted to go the extra mile for Adidas.
Well, I think it was actually the other way. I think Adidas is trying to go the extra mile for him, and this is a little like inside baseball, kind of behind the scenes. But I mean, when you get these signature guys and you lock them into these gigantic shoe contracts, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on shoe companies, I think, to keep them happy. And so he had a launch event in Houston where there was this big rap show. The one on Saturday, they had three events across the country. I want to say it was like Miami, New York, and LA, something like that. And in LA, yeah, he went from kind of store to store, but they closed it off with this big outdoor concert downtown. Not gigantic, but, you know, there's like, they're playing music. There's a live show. Hundreds of people are there dancing. People are break dancing. They had Papa Shot in the background. They had free food trucks. Like, you can get the pho. You can get free pho and banh mi sandwiches. Then they brought it inside. Inside, there was like a VIP lounge where people are hanging out. So it was like at the Nice Kicks is like a sneaker store downtown. That's where they did it. So it was like a pretty big deal. And here was my big takeaway besides, you know, all of the color that I just mentioned. James Harden is really happy right now. By far the happiest I've ever seen him in my life. And actually, I wanted to ask you this question. Have you ever interviewed him or like been around him in media situations? And if so, like, what's the word that comes to mind in terms of like his general presentation?
Okay. So the answer is yes, I have been around him a couple times, and he has always seemed to me to be sort of subdued and like almost sedated with media. Like, there's just not a lot of energy from him. And like, I don't blame guys who are not that excited to talk to reporters, but Harden has always been firmly in that category. And the other time I've been around him, was during the OKC finals when his game was falling apart on national television. And that was like incredibly awkward. And I felt pretty bad for him then. But then in subsequent years, like, he's been great. But with reporters, there's not a lot. He's just not very engaged.
Yeah. So the word that really jumped to me was subdued. I think that pretty much hits it. But it's like an intentional action, right? Like,
yeah,
you
totally feel
like he's got a personality, but he's intentionally downplaying it and kind of hiding it, right? And, you know, I've talked to people who have profiled him, done pretty good profiles of him, who have said similar things. Like, it's just really hard to get him to engage. And a lot has changed for him over the last 4 or 5 months, and everyone's going to want to say Dwight. You know, it's not just the Dwight factor. I think that is a big factor, because a couple things stand out to me over the years of covering the Rockets. One, the first time I saw the Rockets play during the Dwight and Harden era, I just happened to be right behind their team as they were going out into the tunnel, and Dwight was doing all this like slapstick goofy stuff, and there was a whole bunch of guys like kind of clowning around behind him, and Harden was just completely in his own world, not paying any attention to it. And I was like, that's kind of a bad sign.
Well, I think that's the only way to stay sane during some of Dwight's like pregame antics. Do you remember last year? It was before a Rockets Warriors game, and Dwight gathered the team and said, 3, 2, 1, swag champs. And and I think it was Ethan Strauss overheard him doing that. And like, he wrote about it. And I think that confirmed everything we've ever believed about Dwight and how annoying he would be on a daily basis. So I don't blame Harden for like zoning out, because that's the only way to be on Dwight's team and not just snap.
For sure. And the story arc that I saw was right when they first were paired together, Dwight was sort of the ringleader, you know, goof in the middle of the circle, right? Then he gets injured during that one series, comes back for the playoffs. And I did this long phone interview with him where he was basically just like ceded control of the team. He was like, this is James's team now. And he like really meant it, and like completely, basically he was the one who was almost detaching and kind of, you know, sacrificing his touches, his role and so forth. And that was the year they wind up going to the conference finals kind of out of nowhere. But then the third chapter was they tried to put it back together. And I'm sure Dwight just got sick of being in that subjugated role, you know, after a certain amount of time. And I think Harden also realized like there was going to be a better way. Like, for a long time, they were playing better with Capella on the court, even a super young Capella, than they were with Dwight. All the other personality things. So I think that was brewing, like it was reported, for a while. And once it finally happened, I think there was a big time relief, especially from Harden's position of, well, now there's no more questions about whose team this is. And then on top of that, it's not just the Dwight factor. It's how they put the pieces around him afterwards, too, in terms of just finding all of these shooters, finding a coach who just wants to basically let him do whatever he wants with the ball in his hands and understands how valuable a playmaker can be. And I think Harden, the subdued Harden that I've seen in the past, was not there on Saturday. I mean, this was like, I mean, I want to say he was almost outgoing. very friendly body language. He's like patting me on the shoulder, addressing me by my first name. It's like, wait a minute, like, who is this person? Like, we haven't seen him at all during his NBA career. And I think he told the Houston Chronicle recently that the new roster around him is a quote-unquote masterpiece. You know, yeah. He feels like their record is indicative of who they are as a team, and that they let a couple games drop, and they could potentially be, you know, right there with the Clippers standings.
They're really good. The thing, I think, in Dwight's defense, it wasn't just him. Certainly Harden had issues too. Like, you talk about, remember when they beat the Clippers a few years ago?
Yep.
I guess that was the same year they went to the conference finals. That year, like, Harden was on the bench during that comeback against the Clippers, because he was just that bad and that out of it. And he's had a couple moments where you're like, what is the deal with this dude? So, like, I think they both should share blame for what happened last year, because Harden showed up out of shape. I mean, like, half the basketball media was picking Houston to win the West last year, and he was just, like, nowhere near good enough. And I don't think you can put that entirely on Dwight. And to your point, what they've done with this roster is pretty wild. Like, the pieces fit better than I ever thought they would.
They're basically at the best case scenario for what I thought. Everyone stayed healthy, which has been huge, because guys like Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon, I mean, that's going to look different. You know, their offense is going to perform differently if one of those guys lapses into the injury issues they've had in the past. But going back to last year, just real quick, I mean, Harden admits it. You know, he says it's a down year. It's all about how you respond to a down year. And I think I always go back. I think the profile was written by Pablo Torre at the beginning of last season, and just like how ludicrous and distracting his life was entering that season. He's hanging out with the Kardashians, like, you know.
Yeah, the Kardashian red flag.
He really got caught up, I think, in being a superstar. And I think at this point, a year later, he's had time to reflect on that experience. Maybe some of the things that were exciting and new last year in terms of the fame and all that, you know, got him away from what got him there, which was his dedication to basketball.
I actually think that's a real thing, because, like, guys are not used to being internationally famous and being able to do whatever they want. Like, I think at one point he was throwing a party with Kanye on a yacht. And, like, if you come up and become suddenly famous enough to do that, I don't blame guys for being like, yeah, this is how I'm spending my summer. I'm going to be on a yacht with Kanye and the Kardashians. But I think you're right that after a while, like, he may be more centered now. And I also think he didn't enjoy hearing the rest of the league talk shit about his game all of last year. He didn't make All-NBA, which, to me, I hear that and I'm like, well, that is not that big of a deal. But I think these guys take that stuff personally. And it's reflected in the way he's shown up. Just let me read you one quote from Rodney Hood, because I actually have the interview right here. It's running on SI this week, and I asked him about playing James Harden, and he actually laughed. He said, man, he's one of the hardest guys to prepare for in the entire league. He's obviously one of the best one-on-one players and pick-and-roll players, and now he's got so many weapons around him that can shoot the ball, that know their role, guys that can run. That's the biggest thing. You got to keep them out of transition and make them play in the half court, but it's easier said than done. And I think that we've seen that with the whole league. Like, Utah was actually the only team that I've seen them, like, really work at stopping Harden. But, like, basically against everyone else, like, they have an attack that you can't shut down.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You know, in terms of Harden, just the comfort factor, like we were talking about. I mean, I asked him, who's been the MVP so far? He said himself. I asked
technically
him,
he said the beard.
Oh yeah, that's true. He referred to himself in the third person by his preferred nickname, which that might be a first, actually. I'm not sure if I've ever experienced that. But then also, what struck me was how confident he was when I asked him, well, you know, new coach, new teammates, kind of a new role, or, you know, at least like a new full-time point guard is how everyone's now referring to him, right? And I asked him, like, were you surprised how quickly that came together? He's like, not at all. And he basically just said, that's who I've been. I've been waiting to be this player, essentially, is what his answer was. And so he felt like he was hitting the ground running this year. I do think that part of this too, it goes back to the contract, right? And the responsibilities that go when you get that extension. I mean, Houston made a big time commitment in Harden by raising his salary, extending it, making sure he was going to stay in place. They really wanted him to be that foundational piece this summer. And I think when you make that kind of a commitment to a guy who's now 27, you know, he kind of knows who he is. He knows where he's going to be now for basically his prime. I think that comes with a little bit of responsibility too, right? And it kind of reminds me of Westbrook, to be honest, because I think Westbrook's been better with the media this year than at any point in his career too. I think both Harden and Westbrook now are kind of in this maturing stage or matured stage where it's like, okay, some of the stuff that they were doing earlier in their career, some of the anti-media stuff, it just doesn't fly anymore when you're the only star in your market and when you're everybody needs to go to you for quotes, just like everybody's been going to LeBron for quotes about his teams for the last like 7, 8, 9 years, right? And so I really do think in a way that I had never seen previously from Harden, he's embracing that responsibility, right? And that's part of being a franchise guy. And I think the best franchises, the winning franchises, they get that. Like, look at the Warriors. I mean, how media available, you know, accessible is Steph. And it's not just about how friendly are you to reporters, right? But that's one of the little things.
Yeah, I was going to say, it shouldn't be about that. Like, it's also, he's been so good on the court every night that, like, the media stuff is not a big deal one way or the other to me.
I think it is, though, because it's one of those signs that, like, you're serious about doing everything the right way, right? Like, you're serious about going deep and not having excuses and being accountable and understanding that, like, if everyone's going to bash your game for a year, like, you have to come out and answer for that. You can't hide from that, or you can't blame Dwight, or you can't blame anybody else, right? And I think he's doing those things, and that's... To me, that's the sign of a guy who should be in the MVP conversation. I don't know if he's the MVP right now, but I think he's doing all the little things that we blamed Houston for not having, all those chemistry and locker room issues that everybody hinted at last year. To me, he's now the answer to those questions as opposed to being part of the problem.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I have a couple responses here. Number one, like when you describe Harden getting that deal from Houston and he's got the Adidas money too, the first name I thought of is John Wall, because he didn't get the like superstar raise that Westbrook and Harden got. And he's also looking for a shoe deal and did not get a $200 million shoe deal and actually turned down like a, I think it was like an $8 million shoe deal because he thought he was worth more. So like that's the flip side of the James Harden experience is the John Wall experience in DC, where you've got a guy who's just not satisfied with the current state of affairs. But the second thing that I wonder about is how real this is, because we've got to think, cause like when you look at the MVP race, both Harden and Russ have their teams either in the top half of the West or very close to the top half of the West. And I'm just not, it's not that I doubt either one of those teams, but I'm not sure how sustainable either situation is.
And this is how I'd flip it back on that question. Who is the teams that are really going to be threatening them? I mean, who's deeper and fits better and has better talent than those two when you look at that next pack? I mean, Mike Conley going out for Memphis, I really do think that's a killer. You look at Portland. Yeah. I mean, if they're going to continue to have the worst defense or a bottom five defense for the whole year, then you like both Houston and Oklahoma City better than them. I don't think the Lakers are quite there yet. And so,
what about the Jazz?
To me, the Jazz are still the team, and their schedule is supposed to even out here over the next month or so. I think they're the sleeping giant, right? Like, I think they can be a top four team.
We run into this sometimes with the NFL. Like, sometimes there'll be NFL teams that have a good record, and I'm like, you guys are not actually a good team. Like, the Vikings earlier in the year when they were undefeated, I was like, come on, get out of here with the idea that Sam Bradford is on the best team in the NFL. And, like, that's kind of how I feel about the Rockets and Thunder right now. Like, they are ostensibly pretty good and near the elite class, but like they're just not, like I don't see it on that with that roster.
Yeah, I mean, I would not put them in the West top three. Like, I definitely see there's a big cut. Yeah. You know, I still think like the Clippers and Spurs are going to be that second tier, right? But I think that both the Rockets and the Thunder belong firmly in that third tier right there with the Jazz, and that's probably a little bit better than some people expected coming into the season. And when we're looking for reasons or people to credit for that, I think it basically goes all right back to the superstars and the fact that their guys, their rosters around them surround them pretty well.
No, there's no question. I mean, Harden, it's interesting with Harden and Westbrook too, because I think that Westbrook gets a lot more love like nationally. Because, and I wrote about this last week, he's so good at making basketball seem impossible and then doing it anyways. Whereas Harden makes it all look so easy that it's hard to appreciate how good he is. Like he looks effortless to where some people might look at it and say, this is just lazy. He's just like running into the defense and getting fouled. But he is doing basically the exact same thing that Russ is.
Yeah, well, and I think it goes back to the media presentation part of it too. I mean, I hate to harp on
that's
but
a good point.
I really do think that's part of it. Because like Russ, I mean, he'll at least make headlines for the goofy outfits and for the funny looks that he might give a reporter to a stupid question, or, you know, when he's frustrated, some of the curt responses, you know, that stuff has gone viral. And it's kind of contributed to this image of like, oh, he's a star. He's almost like bigger than the reporters who are interviewing him, right? With Harden, it's been for years the subdued responses, like you're saying. I mean, he might score 60 and he never has this amazing one-liner about what it feels like afterwards, right? Or he might have a tough game and he, rather than have a confrontation, you know, it's quiet, seething almost, right?
Yeah.
And in both those situations, it almost contributes to this downplaying effect of like, it's a little bit easier to overlook him. And I understand Rockets fans who are like, first of all, still believe he got snubbed for MVP versus Steph because he quote unquote did more for his
team
that year.
He had a good case that year, man.
Yeah, he did. I was always on Steph's side, but you can understand why they would be frustrated about that. And you could also understand if you're like the Rockets front office and you're negotiating that extension, don't you like get him to like sign that paper and then just you're like, hey, by the way, one last thing. Like, is there any chance you could start having a personality in your interviews?
Beyond the beard? I mean, the beard has taken him a long way.
No, it has.
It's funny because I feel like he was a real cult hero around the league for like the first 4 or 5 years of his career. And then everything changed with Dwight. I don't mean to keep harping on Dwight, but he did like single-handedly turn Harden into a villain.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, have you seen his commercial that came out, this Basketball Needs Creators campaign that they've got Harden in?
Yes, I have seen it. And again, it's hard for me because it's a good commercial. It's kind of funny. There are definitely like 3 or 4 legitimately funny lines, but I haven't totally turned on Harden to the point where I'm ready to like be a fan again.
I'm not suggesting that. I guess when I look at that commercial, didn't that really seem like a pretty powerful philosophical statement though? Like kind of like, you know, F you to the F you to the critics, F you to people like
me.
Were
you brainwashed at this Adidas event?
No, hold on. Hold on a second. Because most of the time I've talked about Harden over the last 3 years, it is to harp, right? I mean, the defense,
yes,
obviously, everybody understands that. We've all seen the YouTube reels. Offensively, you know, it's been, why isn't this working with Dwight like it should, rather than, hey, look at what he's doing, look at these insane usage rates, and so on and so forth. And I think
I think offense is undervalued. I think people have been hating on Harden to an unreasonable extent. Like, bottom line is, if you have a guy who can carry your offense that way, like, you can find guys like Corey Brewer who can hold the defense together. Like, the guys like Harden are incredibly rare.
And I guess what my point was with this commercial is, like, this guy hasn't said anything interesting, basically, in 3 years, right? And then he kind of comes out of nowhere with this commercial that's just like, screw you analytics guys, screw you people who are obsessed with defense, screw you people who want everyone to fit into, like, clean roles and team dynamics. My way works, and it's flashy, you know, and everything else that they mentioned in that commercial in terms of, you know, not being inside the box, doing the Euro step, all the little like cutesy lines that you mentioned. It just seemed to me like this was almost like his coming out party. It's like, I know I've been this sort of like hidden superstar that nobody's really understood. It's like he's taking the beard off to let us really see who he is. You know what I mean?
No, I love it. Yeah,
and
no, and
I
honestly
didn't know that was in there. I guess that's my point. Yeah. I honestly didn't know how he felt about any of this criticism. Like, obviously, he's being mocked. I'm sure he knows it, but he's never really revealed his side of the story.
For sure.
And his side of the story.
Sometime this summer, we should do a podcast about different commercials that have changed the narrative on guys over the years, because I think that happens more than we realize. Like, I don't want to give Whedon and Kennedy and different marketing agencies like too much credit, but I do think that like the KD is not nice thing a few years ago, that became a real thing, and KD sort of adopted it as part of his persona, and it happens more often than we realize. I'm making fun of you, but you're right, and that, like, it's totally a real thing that is happening with Harden now as people begin to appreciate him more. Can you tell me a little bit more about the Adidas party itself?
So essentially, it was designed to sort of make him happy, right? So it's like in downtown LA. He's from LA. It's got his favorite rappers and his favorite rap music, all like custom curated songs. They had
which rappers?
Come on, man. Like, that's asking a lot. but they have like they sort of had it adjacent to this store, which is like a sneaker store downtown. It was just basically like almost like a courtyard, but obviously a concrete courtyard because it was in the middle of downtown. There was, I think it was like invite only. Like, you had to go on social media and get your wristband or whatever, some sort of an application process. Man. So it was like the diehard fans, right? But he also had a lot of friends and family there. And then there was, like I was saying, this VIP room, right? And so as I was interviewing him, he was like doing thumbs up to the bouncers. And he has his personal bodyguard, by the way, looks like Shook Knight. And he's like one of the most intimidating people in the world. If you've ever seen pictures of Harden like off the court, the guy is always there. He's like a body man, like always right there. So look for that if you're really into the Harden lifestyle.
Keep an eye out for Shook Knight's body double.
But he was like personally like, yeah, this person can come in. No, this person can't come in. And it just had this feel of like, this guy's orchestrating the whole show. And it was a very easy parallel to draw between him on the court with the ball in his hands all the time. And like, here's this party being, you know, celebration of his shoes with artwork that has him in the beard silhouette surrounding him with his shoes all over the store, like all four walls. He's right in the middle of all of it. And he's just looks very content. I mean, that was really the big takeaway to me, is like, this guy's got basically everything he wants in life right now.
I am loving your poetic vision of the world right now. And James Harden at the Adidas party, it's all connected, and I'm loving it. I'm also insanely jealous of your connection to the sneaker world. I think there are like 5 or 6 different writers over the past few weeks who have been to these like ridiculous sneaker events. And I really wish I lived in New York or LA so that I could participate in this like insane subculture of basketball, and particularly basketball writing. Because sometimes I go to these things and like there's stuff at every All-Star weekend and whatever. I don't understand how these companies have so much money to spend on these like lavish parties.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's one of the most under-discussed aspect of life as a basketball, right? Like professional basketball. I mean, these guys sell a lot of sneakers. They make a lot of money for the companies. They get huge contracts with the sneaker companies that are usually treated like almost like footnotes. I mean, they don't generally rise to the level of sort of like a headline like we would during July free agency period. But those sneaker companies wield lots of influence. They have very tight relationships with the players themselves. The players
crazy to me. Like, I know they have a lot of money, but $200 million for James Harden does not seem like an investment that is going to get very much of a return for Adidas. And likewise, like spending $800,000 on a crazy party or whatever doesn't seem like a wise way to use the marketing budget. But like, it's just the industry standard of with like the Nikes and the Jordan brands and the Adidases of the world. And it's an amazing business.
Yeah, it really is. And unfortunately, it's also a business that keeps its numbers pretty close to the vest, right?
So we have no idea.
It's really hard for analysts to be like, oh yeah, that was a good investment. That wasn't. I mean, I think we can all agree like plunging all the money into Derrick Rose right before his career goes sideways was probably a killer that cost people their jobs. I mean, there's little doubt about that. I mean, that's pretty tough to recover from. But, you know, when you're looking at like the KD deal or the Steph deal or the LeBron deal or whoever, I mean, how much of those companies' success can be tied back to one sponsor? You know, it's hard to answer. But I don't think there's a lot of people when they're at the Harden party asking those questions. I think they're just having a good
time. No, definitely not. Definitely not. My big takeaway is we need to get John Wall a shoe deal. So that's all I care about. But we should move on. And before we do, today's show is also brought to you by Movement Watches, MVMT. The holiday shopping season is here, and with Movement, you can skip the crowds and standing in crazy lines at the mall, and you can find a gift that your friends or family will love. Ben, tell me about your Movement Watch.
My Movement Watch all blackface, onyx, matches very well with a suit. I mean, theoretically, I could wear it if I wanted to during workouts too, but it's more of a dressy watch look. But they have different bands, so it's really easy, nice and versatile if I want to change up my look. What I really like about Movement Watches, though, MVMTwatches.com, they've got a holiday gift guide, Andrew. You just go to the website and it says, buy this for him, buy this for her. It's like three clicks. Like I said, $100 to $150, but it looks like a $500 watch. So it's easy. It's very quick. You know it's going to ship in time for Christmas, and it's not going to break your bank. What more do you want when it comes to gifts? I mean, give me a break.
No, it's perfect. You know, and the holidays are coming up. It's a great gift for anyone in your life. My brother does not listen to this podcast, so I'm not spoiling anything. I'm probably going to get him a Movement watch, and he'll love it. So anyways, go to MVMTwatches.com/floor and get 15% off today. Check it out.
This is Open Floor with Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver. If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out the MMQB's 10 Things podcast.
Whenever guys get hurt, Gary, I think the tendency to say, oh, a superstar guy is out, well, they're screwed. That's it. But where the difference lies in injuries is not who's getting hurt, it's how those guys are used. And does the guy that replaced you, can you do the same stuff stylistically with him that you do with the other guy? And with Martellus Bennett, the Patriots can still do stylistically everything they did with Gronkowski.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the 10 Things podcast wherever you download your shows.
So we should talk about Draymond.
Yeah, he is really, really pushing this player advocacy thing in new and strange directions, isn't he?
Yeah, and like I almost feel bad because on Friday I started off and it may have sounded like I was defending Draymond.
Uh-oh.
When I was really just sort of like lashing out against the screenshotification of like sports discourse in general. And that is a separate topic from Draymond's whole antics, because like this shit just needs to stop. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of having this discussion. And I think basically he kicked someone during the Rockets game, correct?
He kicked Harden in the head as he was kind of finishing a shot, basically on the way down. His foot was so high in the air, it hit Harden on the descent.
Right. And then the next night, he dislocated some of Marquise Chris's fingers with another kick. And I don't understand why anyone would be opposed to suspending Draymond Green at this point. Like, just clearly whatever they did during the finals was not effective as a deterrent. And like, at some point he's going to need to phase this out of his game and realize that this is not okay, because it is, it's like reckless. It's gonna hurt people. And I just don't get it. Like, this should be an easy decision. The league should see the video from the Suns and say, all right, sit down a game or two.
I knew Marquise Chris's fingers were going to be the straw that broke the camel's back.
I love my young guys, man.
Yeah. No, he's like your favorite player. And this was just a complete perfect storm for you to be agitated. Well, let me ask you this. If you're Marquise Chris and you're injured after this play, and then you look and contrast that with the finals, Draymond Green, you know, tapping LeBron, he's fine. And he was so injured, he went on to have the best three-game stretch of arguably any player in NBA history. But you're Marquise Chris, and you're sitting there nursing your finger injury. Do you start thinking there's a double standard here? I mean, that's pretty compelling, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there might be a Marquise Chris LeBron double standard. No, the thing with the finals is, that was like, that happened in context to where Draymond knew that he was on like double secret probation after the game against the Thunder that he should have been suspended for kicking Steven Adams in the balls. Like, I don't think what Draymond did in the finals was enough to merit a suspension, because it was like a light tap or whatever. This is such a ridiculous conversation to have, but like what he did against the Thunder should have been a suspension. And the kicking is the stuff that is really the main issue here. He's got to phase that out of his game. And I don't understand how anyone but Draymond can think it's a bad idea to suspend him. Like, if I were Steve Kerr, I would be like, yeah, suspend him for that. Get, like, teach him a lesson.
Well, do you buy his defense that it's just how his body works and it's natural? Or do you really believe the NBA's line that it's an unnatural act? I mean, what do you see his intent as?
I kind of hate that we have to parse language
I know, but that's where we're at. I mean, we have to do that. Like, where do you fall on it?
I think it is probably to some degree a natural act on Draymond's part, but I also think that, like, it's the sort of thing that you can control if you know it's going to get you in trouble. Like, even if it is natural, then someone needs to tell him that, like, yo, I know this is how your body naturally reacts, but you're going to have to phase that out. I mean, guys have to do that with all kinds of different, like, mechanics as they improve their shooting, whatever. Like, it's a normal thing. And he's got to phase out the leg kicks and the nut kicks. And, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem like this should be that complicated for him.
I think I'm more sympathetic to Draymond than you are in general. I still think that he's wrong on this one, or at least misrepresenting the issue on this one. Number one, I think that he can control it more than he believes. I think number two, he really created a false equivalence when he tried to compare his kicking to James Harden's finishing in traffic. Basically, he was saying that
James Harden's not hurting people.
Exactly. Well, number one, he's not hurting people. And then number two, like, there is a pretty obvious, like, strategic advantage to what Harden's trying to do, right? Like, he's trying to draw fouls. Like, what is the strategic advantage that Draymond's trying to do with these fall through leg kicks? I don't personally believe that following through as strongly as he does is going to influence the foul calls from the officials, right? Like, I think it's unnecessary embellishment. Like, he's already flailing in other ways. He's either going to get the call or he's not. With Harden,
right?
It's a move that's going, you know, like, the sweep through on the layups that he's doing is really with the intent of trying to finish, but then also really trying to increase the probability that he gets hit in the first place, which I think is different. And, you know, asking Harden about this, like, he kind of said the same thing. He's like, look, my move is natural enough that everybody's trying to copy it, you know? And are there people out there who are trying to leg kick like Draymond?
Yeah, nobody's trying to karate kick their way through the NBA like Draymond Green. Can I also say that, like, his defense, I kind of understand why he would react that way. I'm just tired of the persecution complex that's coming out of Golden State. It's like anytime anything happens, they play the victim and say that the whole country hates them and that we're the villains.
Hold on. Is it all of them or is it just Draymond? I mean, let's be real specific.
It's certainly Draymond is the face of the persecution complex movement among the Warriors. Steph Curry, the one Warrior who actually has taken all kinds of unfair shit over the last like 9 months, never says a word. And it's really only Draymond and KD. And KD was doing it even as he went on a publicity tour after his decision this summer. Like, he was talking about how the whole world hates him. Like, nobody was really mad that he left OKC, except OKC fans. It was just more people being kind of fairly, I think, skeptical of the decision to go join OKC's toughest competition. But, like, more than anything else, I just don't think anyone hates the Warriors that much.
I hear what you're saying. I think, for me, the bigger issue is not that they're putting out their thoughts. I always want to hear what these guys are thinking, and I credit both of them for, you know, being pretty open in what's going on inside their brains, especially Draymond, maybe slightly too open for his own good, but, you know, he's very open. I just also think that they're both really intelligent guys, right? And I think, especially in this specific case with Draymond and the kick, I think he's got to step outside of himself and realize that a lot of what he's saying just doesn't really add up logically or make sense. And he's saying it from a very defensive position because he feels like the league is picking on him. And that's the time in all of our lives where we start to lose the most logic, right? Like, when you're hammering me for all the crazy things I said about D'Angelo Russell, like, of course I'm not going to make sense when I'm responding about that, you know? And I think he's sort of in that same situation where he's saying things like, oh, the guys in the NBA league office, like, they've never played basketball. It's like, dude, like, Kiki Vandeweghe was really good. Like,
yeah, there are a lot of guys who have played basketball. And
they study this,
like,
you know?
Draymond is a professional athlete. Like, I understand that it may be hard to control his limbs, but, like, if anyone should be expected to have body control, it's, like, one of the best power forwards in the NBA. And so I don't think people are being too unfair to say, look, you're legitimately hazardous to people around you. So just figure this out or you're going to start getting suspended.
Yeah, and I also think that we've seen over the years, as you change rules, player behavior does change, whether it's blows to the head in transition, knocking guys out of the air, whether it's touching the basketball after it goes through the hoop and that crazy delay a game thing that they were whistling for a while. I mean, that really changed how players, you know, react to kind of a subconscious act. I mean, players adapt. When people are getting injured or when there's consistently the possibility of injury, what is the NBA supposed to do besides crack down on that? Just like let it happen and turn a blind eye? I just don't understand what leg Draymond really thinks he's standing on. And that's a terrible pun.
It's a great pun. I love it. Yeah, no, that's my main thing is I don't even think this should be a debate at this point. Like if he keeps doing this, like suspend him. That's the end of the story. And I'm sorry for, I feel like a couple minutes ago, I might've been like lashing out a little bit too hardcore about the Warriors, but there's a lot of quotes that make me sort of eye roll. Like Draymond was talking about all the people who doubted their defense a couple weeks ago. And it's just like, just chill, play basketball. Nobody's rooting against the Warriors right now. They're not the same team that like the LeBron Heat were in 2011. I think we're in kind of a different place.
People do delight when they lose, though. I mean, the 3-1 jokes, the Steph Curry sneaker jokes.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe, like, online, it's a different experience for them. The 3-1 jokes definitely were pretty rough. I don't blame them for a lingering resentment over that.
But here's the other thing, too, is your whole worldview as a professional athlete should not be shaped by the hate that you get on Twitter, right? That's, like, the most distorted possible lens to look through the world. And I've actually heard Durant say this in interviews, too. Like, when he goes around, when he's, you know, just going about his business in life, he's never actually had anyone criticize his decision to his face or, like, kind of bring that up to him outside of maybe an NBA arena where, like, it's the rival fans who are mad at him. And so I don't understand why some people react so strongly to the hate they get on Twitter when their actual reality, everything's fine. You know what I mean? Like who's the problem here? Is it you or is it the people who are on Twitter screaming at you about it? You know?
Yeah, man, you're the leader of the movement. Don't read your mentions. Still the only person I've ever met who actually does not read any mentions. It's a healthy approach. I like it.
But you know what I'm saying though? I think that places like Twitter can feed that persecution complex a lot.
Totally. Yeah, no, I and the 3-1 jokes, like I don't even think about that as like a real thing, but I'm sure that those guys do. And that makes sense to me. So maybe that's where some of this comes from. Either way, I don't think it's like a good look for them. I think they're better off not answering your critics. And like when guys on Twitter, fellow writers, when they answer trolls and like quote the tweet, I never like when people do that. And maybe that's just my own personal thing, but like, just don't talk down to the lowest like 5%, whether you're a Golden State Warrior or you're us, like whatever. It just doesn't make sense.
Don't argue with fools from a distance. People can't tell who is who. All right, next topic.
Exactly. Next topic. Should we talk about Steve Kerr?
What? How he gets high?
My one takeaway from that was like a little bit different than... It was tough to read him talk about pain treatment and say that I've tried everything and nothing has worked. And so I tried marijuana and that didn't work either. Like aside from the whole legalization debate, like I think it should be legal, but it's kind of disturbing that he's in that much pain and it's continued like a year later, a year after the back issues.
Well, look, he's aged more than Obama over the last 3 years, you know?
I know. And it's hard to watch. I kind of want to be like, look, Steve, you are one of like the brightest minds in the NBA, a genuine, like a bright presence. Like I smile when Steve Kerr start, like he's self-deprecating, he's fun, and I want him to be happy. I don't, and he sometimes I'll see him on the sidelines and he just looks unhappy.
I think him and Sam Hinkie need to like just take up a cause like climate change and just fix it for us. Like those are the two smartest guys the NBA's got.
Yeah, he's probably being wasted in the NBA. But I don't know. We don't need to spend too much time on the weed stuff. I do kind of like it.
Did you see Earl Watson's response? So I thought that was pretty interesting.
What did he say?
He was like, we have to be real careful about how we talk about marijuana because, you know, in inner cities, marijuana is the kind of thing where that could be your first strike and that can lead to you getting into, you know, serious trouble with the criminal justice system. And it can take you down a completely different path. And you know, for some people, you know, marijuana might be a painkiller or an alternative medicine. But for others, that can be something that can really impact your life in a really negative way, even if it's not the actual plant itself. It's just sort of the criminalized process around it.
Yeah.
And so what he's basically saying is, you know, Steve Kerr, with the gigantic platform that he has, just needs to be careful. And the NBA needs to be careful about what its stance is publicly, because that could really impact a lot of kids' lives. I think, I mean, that's a perspective that you don't really get a lot into the mainstream media, that personally, like, it would be very easy for me to overlook that perspective, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's also, I think it's a good reminder that most places around America, like, weed is still illegal. So it's kind of a moot point in terms of what the NBA wants to embrace or not. And it is a good reason for the NBA to be cautious, at least while, like, most states still have it criminalized.
Exactly. Hey, did you see Klay Thompson's comment?
No. The expert on the subject.
Well, his comment was that no one should ever use marijuana for recreational use. That was his official on the record comment, which nice. That was interesting.
Yeah, I love Klay. Always will.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out the Seth Davis podcast.
I asked Fran Fraschilla about whether he thinks Knight will ever come back to Indiana for some type of ceremony.
He was perfectly clear about the fact that he was excited they were going to be honored, but that in no way, shape, or form was he coming back. And my sense, Seth, quite frankly, is he will never come back.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the Seth Davis podcast wherever you download your shows.
Let's talk about, go from the super team to the teams that are chasing them. Your SI piece this week. We got 15 more minutes. Tell me what you wrote about.
So it's mostly about the Clippers, but to kind of look at the overall issue, I talked to both Doc Rivers and Dwayne Casey about it. They're kind of in this chase pack, right? Like, of the teams that are maybe that second tier team, sort of kind of trying to threaten the Cleveland and the Golden State dominance. And I was just trying to get a sense for, like, psychologically, how do you get your teams ready for that? You know, do you use these matchups as sort of like comparison points, or do you try to really motivate them? Sort of like, remember Frank Vogel a couple years ago was like, we have to get home court advantage against the Heat, right? So that was like their whole season goal to do that. It ended up not working or mattering, but like, that's kind of how he focused them. And then also just in free agency, when you're a team like the Clippers and the Raptors, and you're just trying to kind of get by in free agency, not lose too many pieces, you hope Biombo doesn't crush you when he leaves. You hope Jeff Green doesn't crush you. Obviously, he wouldn't. But, you know, you're in a situation where it's very hard to add talent. You're just trying to keep it together. And then all of a sudden, you know, Golden State adds a Kevin Durant. I mean, how do you respond to that? Or do you have resentment about that? And the coaching perspective on this was pretty interesting, because there's only so many things they can control. Even a guy like Doc Rivers, who has a very active hand in their player personnel, right? Like, there's only so many things he can control. Once they strike out on Kevin Durant, Golden State gets him, what's he supposed to do? Whine about it? And so they took a very hard line, both of them, basically saying, look, like, there's no room for jealousy. There's no room for lack of a better word, bitching. We shouldn't be upset about the super team phenomenon. It helps drive ratings. Everybody benefits in the long run from having these good teams. And the way Doc put it was like, look, there's just not enough talent to go around, right? So someone's always going to be in that situation where, you know, they have the advantage and everybody else is playing chase. And I think he's coming at it from the perspective of, well, he did have a super team, you know, in 2008 with the Celtics. I mean, that big three.
They were the first super team, really.
Yeah, and so I think he can't really be a hypocrite and say, oh yeah, super teams are terrible at this point because of it. But he also was really trying hard to downplay the rivalry. You know, same thing with Dwayne Casey. I mean, you know, I think he believes his team is capable of beating the Cavaliers, but he doesn't want any part of that conversation, doesn't want to talk about statement games, doesn't want to talk about a rivalry, doesn't want to talk about the Raptors now being a team that other teams get up for. Like, remember Drake night, the Warriors went in there and like really tried to stick it to the Raptors. The Cavaliers, yeah. The second game they played the Raptors, they really just tried to kind of send a message to them. That was my interpretation from watching it. He doesn't want any part of that discussion. And these coaches are really trying to frame it like, keep all of the pressure on those top two teams, right? Downplay any rivalry talk, downplay any sort of, oh yeah, maybe the Clippers have the number one defense in the league. Well, we don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about Golden State's amazing shooters, right? And I just think
that's a smart approach.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, like, is that how you would handle it? Or would you be out there being like, yeah, we want the Warriors. Yeah, we want the Cavaliers. Because there's a lot of different ways you could come at this question. Because they're not going anywhere, right? Like, you know you have to get through them if you want to win a title. Like, there's just really no way around it. Everybody gets it. I mean, 1 month into the season, they're right there at the top of the standings. Both have strong point differentials. So how would you handle it if you were a coach?
I think if you're Doc or Dwayne Casey, you have to be careful about talking up like a rivalry, because you just have to be realistic. Like, looking at the Cavs, like, all things being equal, the Cavs are going to win pretty easily anytime they're against the playing the Raptors. Certainly in the playoffs, the Cavs are not worried about the Raptors. Like, last year's conference finals in the East were so disrespectful. I don't even think people realized as it happened, but like, the Cavs didn't show up for like half the games and we're just like, whatever, screw it. Like, we'll win when we need to. So I think if you're Dwayne Casey, like, you don't want to frame everything as a competition with the Cavs, because then in all likelihood, it's going to end pretty badly and you're going to end up looking pretty bad. And the same is true for the Clippers. Maybe even more so, to where like, the history with the Warriors over the last 2 years is not great for Doc and for any of those guys.
He points out, by the way. I mean, he can rattle those stats off the top of his head. We've lost this many straight to Cleveland. We've lost this many to Golden State.
Which is a very healthy shift for him, because he came into last year sort of talking about the Warriors as if their title had an asterisk, because they didn't have to play the Clips in the conference finals after the Clippers had collapsed to the Rockets. So that was not a great look. And I think Doc's approach this year makes a lot more sense. And if you're the Raptors or the Clippers, like, you're basically saying, like, let's focus on getting to the conference finals and then hope that something else goes wrong. I mean, obviously Doc can't say this and neither can Dwayne Casey, but hope that something goes wrong for those guys to where it becomes more of a level playing field. Like, if it's the Raptors and the Cavs in May and Kyrie is hurt, then it becomes like a little bit more interesting. I'd still probably take the Cavs in that series. But if you're the Clippers and you're talking about taking away one of those Warriors guys, like, if one of them pulls a hamstring, Steph, he certainly was banged up last year, like, then it becomes a lot more realistic, because there's not a lot of depth on that team. So, like, I like the approach that they're taking, where, look, we'll talk when we get to June, but this is not, we're not going to play the entire year in opposition to them.
Here's what Doc told me. He said, I know the Lakers and Celtics were a rival, but now we have these quick drive-through rivalries where you have one go at them and all of a sudden you're supposed to be a rival. We've only played the Warriors one series and we won that series, which I thought was nice, because that was a little shade. But I guess that series started the rivalry. Even before I got here, there was all this talk about the Warriors and the Clippers not liking each other. That's good. So maybe we've got a state rivalry. But I don't really care.
They used to play like really physical games too. Like, Bogut and Draymond would beat up Blake. I mean, that's where the rivalry started.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Everybody else agrees that it's a rivalry. Like, this is a very obvious rivalry. It's these guys who are denying it. And also, by the way, Blake always denies that it's a rivalry. I've asked him like 4 different times if it's a rivalry. Every time it's like, it's not a rivalry.
I think that's healthy. Look, if it's a rivalry, it's not going well for the Clippers. So, yeah.
Like, so here's another thing from Doc real quick. He goes, we want to beat them and they want to beat us. Not because we don't like them. Maybe we do and maybe we don't, but we want to beat them because they're in our way and we'd like to be in their way. So he just has these little subtle jabs of being like, yeah, like, in between the lines, I hate their guts. And in between the lines, scoreboard, we beat them the only time we played them in the playoffs. But at the same time, it's not a rivalry. It's not that important. We got to downplay it.
You know who really hates them? Is Chris Paul. Chris Paul is so pissed off about the rise of Steph Curry, and you can see it every single game that they face off. And it's great, because pissed off Chris Paul is one of the most entertaining players in the league. And like,
wouldn't you say the same about Blake though too? I mean, don't you think of all the annoyances that we've talked about Draymond, don't you think the number one person in the world who would be annoyed by Draymond would be Blake?
Oh, definitely. I just think that Blake is less fun when he's annoyed. When I hear the words annoyed Blake, I think of him complaining to officials. Whereas when I hear the words like pissed off Chris Paul, I think of him going at Steph Curry and being like overly physical with him on defense to where he's fouling him so often that like the refs can't even call half of them. And it's fun, man. It's fun to watch those two go off.
For sure. Another thing Doc said was that basically the way he frames it is the Cavaliers and the Warriors, they have championship swagger, and that his team hasn't earned the right to stride like them. And I think he was referring to maybe their behavior in that Nets game, you know, where they were, Chris Paul was like pumping Paul Pierce's chest and they give the game away. It's a collapse in double overtime. Doc gets ejected. It's like this big point of frustration moment. And so it does seem like he's trying to find the line between like making sure these guys are having a good time this season, but not having too much fun, because there's also a danger, I think, in trying to be like the super teams, right? Like Golden State's out there, free-flowing offense, having a great time. The Clippers are clearly trying to move the ball and pass the ball more this year. Their passing stats are all super high.
Yeah.
But you don't want to fall into that trap of like, let's try to take on their personality or beat them at their game, because that, to me, is a losing proposition, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I also feel like we have calibrated our Clippers. Like, our Clippers expectations are calibrated correctly at this point. I think a couple weeks ago, we were talking about them like they were the best team in the league. And now, and they've had a couple losses that have made some people do a double take to where, like, well, let's wait and see what happens with the Clippers. And I think that's, like, the correct approach, because, like, they lost to the Pacers at home last night, and they've had just a couple iffy performances where, like, they still have the pieces to compete with Golden State better than just about anyone outside of Cleveland. And maybe better than Cleveland. It'll be interesting to see what happens, but I don't think we can put them on that level right now. And I think that's the thing that Doc gets.
And that's really the point of my piece too, is like, these are the teams that are in the chase mode, right? Like, and their whole worldview is, we want to be in the best position, so if something goes wrong with, you know, something goes wrong with the Warriors or Cavaliers, that you're primed to take advantage of that. But you can't say that publicly, of course. But I think that they're also realistic. Like, I think both Doc Rivers and Dwayne Casey understand that there's a talent gap between their rosters and those super teams, right? They're not delusional.
So let me ask you two more questions before we finish up here. While you were at the Adidas party gallivanting around with James Harden, I was at a Florida State George Washington basketball game meeting some scout friends of mine. One of the questions that came up was a debate. Like, would you rather have J.J. Redick or Avery Bradley?
J.J. Redick.
Really?
I love Avery Bradley, and actually I think in the top 100 blurb about him, I wrote that the world needs more Avery Bradleys, which Celtics fans got really excited about, probably because they were trying to figure out how they could trade for an Avery Bradley clone and give up nothing of consequence in their trade scenario. But Redick is an unbelievable shooter. If you look at his just points per possession on the catch and shoots, how much attention he draws with his off-ball movement, how much space he creates for his teammates, how quick his trigger is. I mean, all of those things to me are just like special, special, special gifts. And then I think defensively, he's solid. I mean, he's part, he plays huge minutes on the NBA's number one defense right now.
Redick is really underrated as far as, like, his offense is better than people realize, and his defense isn't anywhere near as bad as some people used to think. And I think he's a bigger part of that Clippers team than outside. Like, people talk about the Clips and say Blake, DeAndre, and CP3, but like, Redick is really, really good.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because that's how my SI story opens, the magazine story. So good job.
All right.
This is
all right,
perfect
good
synergy.
I think the reason I would have pause is because Avery Bradley, when you give him an assignment, it, like, put him on a guard like Steph, he covers them like a shutdown corner, basically, end to end, just never leaves a guy like that. And that can be really valuable and would certainly help the Clippers in ways that Redick doesn't. People were divided yesterday. It was a group of like four or five people. And Basically, if you trust Avery Bradley's defensive reputation, it's a really close call. So
this is one of those transferability conversations that we get into with the top 100, because the nice part about Avery Bradley is that dude's a dog no matter what team he plays for, right? So you could have like the crappiest roster around him, you're always going to get the elite on-ball defense. Whereas with Reddick, you have to at least have a number one or number two option to really unlock his scoring and his shooting. Otherwise, he's going to start to fall by the wayside a little bit more. And we saw that during the playoffs when some of those guys got injured last year. It's like all of a sudden his efficiency takes a hit. He's not quite the same weapon. So for you can make an argument that Bradley might be a little bit more transferable. But I think in their current context, Bradley on the Celtics or Reddick on the Clippers, I'd take Reddick, but not by much.
Yeah. Okay. Final question. Did Dwayne Casey confront you about 46 and your crimes against Canada and the Raptors?
No, Dwayne Casey's way too classy to do that. He had no real issues. I was, to be honest, I was hoping for a thank you. You know, like, hey, we needed to motivate DeMar after this big contract over the summer. I was glad you came through with the 46 ranking to really inspire him to start the season off right. No, Dwayne Casey's an incredibly nice man. And here's a little trivia question
for
you.
He does seem like a really nice guy.
Here's a trivia question for you. Do you know who the longest tenured coach in Raptors history is?
I want to say Butch Carter. That was like the sweet spot of my Raptors fandom when it was Butch Carter and Vince Carter and Tracy McGrady. But other than that, I have no idea.
It's Dwayne Casey. He is now the,
that even been though my he, second guess.
Even though he's been on the hot seat for like 9 straight years, not really, but
he's been
solid,
on the hot seat the entire time he's been there.
A solid 3.5 or 4 years. He is now the longest tenured coach in Raptors history. And when you start to think about it, like this year, no real talk about that from any of the media. And they have a pretty excitable local media there in Toronto. I mean, yes. Casey's just firmly in place. Lowry and DeRozan are firmly in place. The offense,
they've focused all their angst on you.
Yeah, the offense is just like completely, proven formula. They know where they're going. They have a couple of young pieces in the front court they're working in. But they're at a more stable position than really any time they've been, probably ever in terms of their franchise. So that's why it was an interesting time to talk to him about some of the things that they're going through, because you can have the best moment in Raptors history and still feel like there's a gulf between that and where the Cavaliers are right now, right? And that's just a really tricky psychological situation to be in. But no, he didn't bring up any SI Top 100 conversations.
Good. I'm happy for you that you were able to avoid any confrontations with Coach Casey, and Raptors fans can focus all their energy on firing Ben Golliver for the rest of the year. But
hey,
I don't want you to get fired. I enjoy these talks, our fireside NBA chats. Let's catch up on Friday, though, man. We got more mailbag. We've got a lot of questions left over from last week, but anyone with additional queries, hit us up on Twitter, and we'll answer everything on Friday.
Hey, one more thing just real quick. You were mentioning MacWeldon.com, promo code open. MVMTwatches.com/floor.
Forever Mac Weldon. That's what we're about. And Movement Watches, yeah. All right, man. I'll talk to you Friday.
Hey, stay out of trouble. Stay safe.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.